Chapter 5. The Descent into Hades. There's a price to pay for reward. It used to be measured in dollars, pounds, or yen, but now it's measured in neurons. As the monetary price of reward fell, the physiological price of reward skyrocketed. Because those dopamine receptor-harboring neurons in the nucleus accumbens are fragile. They want to be tickled. That's why they have dopamine receptors in the first place. But they're very sensitive. They don't want to be bludgeoned. If you open the dopamine floodgates repeatedly, those neurons have some fail-safe methods built in to protect themselves. The goal is to have an optimal level of dopamine receptors so that even a minuscule dopamine rush, like a trip to the nail salon, can find an open receptor and generate a unique pleasure from the experience. Obviously, a bigger rush, a couple of glasses of scotch or jumping out of an airplane, will occupy more receptors and generate a bigger reward. But stimulating the dopamine receptors excites that next neuron in the nucleus accumbens. And overstimulation with multiple rapid firings can cause those receptor-containing neurons to go into overdrive, leading to cell damage or death, termed excitotoxicity. To protect themselves from your irrational exuberance, each neuron has a built-in subcellular program that reduces the number of receptors on its surface. The more dopamine chronically released from the VTA neuron, the fewer dopamine receptors will be available on the NA neuron to transduce that signal for reward. This is the law of mass action. Everything kept in check. The firing squad. When cells in your body die, they are usually replaced with new ones. Not so with the brain, with few exceptions, like the hippocampus, which plays a role in the depression story. Once a primitive brain cell, or neuroblast, turns into a functioning neuron and starts firing, it loses the capacity to divide again. Clearly, chronic stimulation of neurons resulting in cell death with no chance for replacement is not in your best interest. So nature developed a plan B that's semi-protective. Ligands, molecules that bind to receptors like dopamine or cortisol, almost uniformly downregulate their own receptors all over the body. In other words, nature makes it so that the locks can be rekeyed or even shut down. But it also means that the response of the cell won't be as robust the next time around. You will need more to get less. The downregulation of receptors is a phenomenon called tolerance. The receiving neuron is becoming tolerant to the excessive stimulus. This is both good and bad. It's good because it means your neurons aren't dead. It's bad because the next time you go looking, you're going to need more of the substance in order to get the same level of reward, which ups the ante. Tolerance is a standard response in medicine and occurs with virtually every chemical that binds to a receptor, whether it be in the brain, the gut, the muscle, the liver, or anywhere else for that matter. Tolerance is how cells and you survive. But when neurotransmitters bludgeon the receiving neuron en masse and without cessation, they can overstimulate and eventually kill that neuron through a process of programmed cell death called apoptosis. Chronic excitation of almost any neuron can lead to cell death. This is a common phenomenon in neuroscience, and it's a necessary process. Apoptosis is inherent to all cells in the body. It's the self-destruct program that keeps good cells from turning bad, for example, cancer. Trimming and pruning. There are two ways for a cell to die: necrosis, poisoning it from the outside, or apoptosis, self-destruction from the inside. Drugs can do both. They can poison the cell outright, or they can beat it into permanent submission. Apoptosis is a normal and very important process throughout the body that clears away overworked, mutated, or just plain old and decrepit cells. It's especially important during gestation in the womb. We all start out as a single cell, a zygote, and by adulthood we end up a conglomeration of 10 trillion cells which have differentiated into hundreds of various cell types along the way. Think of apoptosis as the human equivalent of bonsai, the Japanese art of pruning and sculpting trees to take on new and beautiful dimensions. Otherwise, they're just gangly weeds. And throughout the various organs of the body, except for the majority of the brain, we maintain the capacity to be able to divide, regrow, and replace cells even as they are cleared away by apoptosis. Adults appear smarter than toddlers for three reasons. They have more white matter, the fatty part of the brain that insulates neurons and helps transmit impulses faster, which increases information transmission speed. They have a more developed PFC, the executive function center, or Jiminy Cricket of the brain, and they generally have more experience to draw on. But the number of neurons remains the same. That's why IQ tests can be administered as early as age 4. If your 4-year-old self could see you now, Marlon Brando's words from On the Waterfront, 1954, would no doubt reverberate. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. So keeping your neurons happy and healthy throughout your life should be part of your prime directive. Yet many of us spend our lives bombarding our synapses with substances and behaviors that downregulate receptors through the law of mass action, or act as poisons like alcohol, taking out perfectly good neurons, or with substances that provide different forms of excitation, including illicit drugs of abuse, or too much coffee, too much stress, and not enough sleep. They either rapidly necrose from the outside, or more likely, slowly apoptose from the inside. And then pleasure is strewn to the wind because those neurons are not coming back. This process is different from developing tolerance. Tolerance is the downregulation of receptors with the chance of coming back. Once a neuron's dead, it ain't never coming back. There's less to work with, and you can't make more neurons, all of which comes down to the same result. You need more to get less. As an illustration, let's choose a peanut butter cup, the cheapest of all thrills, but it just could have easily have been a shot of espresso or vodka. In terms of the reward neuron, the initial script is the same. Get a desire, dopamine. Get a fix. Get a rush, EOPs. Yum. But man, that peanut butter cup was so delicious, just the right amount of peanut butter, salt, chocolate, and sugar, specifically engineered to hit your bliss point, as chronicled by Michael Moss. Go ahead, eat the second one. They come two to a package, after all. Get another rush. This one won't last as long as the first one because there are fewer receptors. Tomorrow, you go get another package at Walgreens. They're staring at you right on the counter. And dig in for your third hit. But you know, you just can't recapitulate that gustatory nirvana again. More should be able to do it. The next day, you buy the 6-pack. And now, that extra fix means your receptors are downregulated even more. So, now you decide to put the pedal to the metal. The economy size bag has now become your standard, and it's just giving you way less response than you ever had. The cashier at Safeway now recognizes you, and now you have so few reward-transducing receptors, you hardly break a smile. You want the yum, but even after eating the Halloween-sized bag and a couple of pints of ice cream while watching The Notebook, 2004, you still aren't satisfied. Pickling your brain. Every substance and behavior that drives up your reward triggers will just as quickly drive down your reward receptors. Different types of rewards, chronically and in excess, all have the same effect. Why is it that alcoholics can consume so much more booze than your average drinker? Their livers have a much higher tolerance because repeated and high exposure has increased their capacity to metabolize the alcohol. Their brains also have a higher tolerance because the alcohol has been driving those VTA neurons, which have been bombarding those receptors in the NA with dopamine for so long, they need a lot more to fly the friendly skies. A true lush will get less pleasure from a pint of bourbon than your average normal drinker will get from a single cocktail. If you stop the nosedive here, before your neurons are deep-sixed, you have a fighting chance of pulling out, like a withered flower that's waiting for rain. If the postsynaptic neurons are only damaged but still alive, your dopamine receptors can regenerate over time. You can bring your reward system back and start over, although dopamine receptors aren't back to normal for at least 12 months. One reason for overdose is that addicts, after coming out of a period of abstinence stemming from rehab or jail, will go straight to the last dosage of their drug of choice because they no longer have that same level of tolerance. Their previous dose is now an overdose. But keep nosediving and you're sure to crash. Next on the hit parade is the snowball effect. Your VTA dopamine neurons, the drivers of the reward signal, are themselves in overdrive. They're working their little nuclei off trying to manufacture more enzymes to make more dopamine, even though your pleasure quotient's almost negligible because those dopamine receptors are so downregulated. Now both your dopamine neurons and their target receptors are flirting with initiating that apoptotic self-destruct sequence. At some point down the line, they're going to give up. You now have much less of the reward pathway than you used to. You will never reach that same level of reward as before, ever, because you just don't have the machinery to do so. You're constantly trying to recapture that first high, chasing the dragon, but you'll never be able to because those neurons are dead. When you fly with one engine, you're much more apt to crash and burn. People in recovery from illicit substances have a motto. Once a cucumber becomes a pickle, it will never be a cucumber again. But wait, there's more. A third phenomenon often comes part and parcel with tolerance. Some of our favorite rewards have extra pain built right in. Once you've become tolerant and you're spending your salary to maintain your fix, you wake up and decide it's time to quit. But changes in those neurons have occurred. The acute cessation of many of these substances can lead to severe and extremely unpleasant experiences known as withdrawal. They tend to cluster as symptoms of physiological withdrawal, like caffeine, alcohol, narcotics, tranquilizers, with effects on the body such as sweating, racing heart, palpitations, muscle tension, chest tightness, difficulty breathing, tremor, and GI complaints such as nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Some, like delirium tremens, DTs, from alcohol withdrawal, or hallucinations from benzodiazepine or benzo withdrawal, or barbiturate downer withdrawal, can be life-threatening. Or symptoms can cluster as manifestations of emotional withdrawal, like from cocaine, marijuana, and ecstasy, with effects on the brain such as anxiety, restlessness, irritability, insomnia, headaches, poor concentration, depression, and social isolation. These symptoms of withdrawal can be so severe as to prevent people from even wanting to give up their drug or behavior of choice, and they often lead abusers to relapse. Tolerance and withdrawal are the classic two-headed hydra of the definition of addiction. An equal opportunity offender. When there is too much dopamine, there can be too much motivation to obtain your pleasure. The motivation, the wanting, becomes more of a needing. Many addicts commit a host of crimes to obtain their fix, often hurting loved ones in the process. They drive drunk, lose custody of their children, and not infrequently become destitute. It can happen to anyone. A friend of mine recently had back surgery and was prescribed oxycodone, or OxyContin. Within a brief time period, she stopped needing the drug to ameliorate her physical pain, but she still needed it to occupy those few remaining opioid receptors. She became a drug-seeking doctor shopper, doing whatever she could to fill her next prescription. The pain she suffered was not from her back, but rather from her desperation to obtain her next fix. Her dopamine put her in 24/7 motivation overdrive, while her oxycodone didn't pack the punch she needed to calm herself down. We often hear of famous people entering the Betty Ford Center to dry out. Did they get addicted and then get famous? No. Drug abuse is a response to the stresses of everyday life. And apparently, famous people have stresses too. People often say addiction is a choice. After all, Nancy Reagan argued you could just say no. And despite overwhelming evidence that nicotine caused both tolerance and withdrawal, the tobacco industry used free choice as its cornerstone defense from the 1960s through the 1990s. In 1994, on national television, Thomas Sandefur, the CEO of Brown & Williamson, William Campbell, the CEO of Philip Morris, and James Johnston, the CEO of R.J. Reynolds, all testified under oath, "I believe nicotine is not addictive." So how did the tobacco companies get away with saying nicotine was not addictive, and for so long? What were the criteria? Well, they couldn't deny tolerance and withdrawal, so they played down the concern by equating it with other hedonic substances. According to the tobacco companies, and this is a quote, "Addiction is an emotive subject, and it is certainly possible to define the term broadly enough to include smoking. The current definition is more colloquial and certainly applies to the use of many common substances that have familiar pharmacological effects to cigarettes, such as coffee, tea, chocolate, and cola drinks." Hey, don't pick on us. We're no worse than Coca-Cola. Whether they knew it or not, they actually got it right. Individuals in society have found pleasure in all forms of reward. To each his own. Some are substances, and some are behaviors, which we engage in specifically because they feel good. It doesn't matter. The final common pathway is dopamine. Some behaviors are innate, like eating and sex. Some are learned, like shopping or shoplifting or gambling or gaming or texting or binging on Netflix. Similar to taking drugs of abuse, overperforming each of these behaviors can also manifest the phenomenon of tolerance, performing the behavior more and more to get less and less reward. Some will be so driven by their dopamine to greater and greater extremes to get that ever-diminishing EOP rush that they will escalate up to deviant behavior, some of which are severe enough to put you face-to-face either with the law or with your maker. How are these behaviors, as bizarre as they are, considered addictions? While they clearly manifest tolerance, more and more for less and less, they do not demonstrate either the physiological or the emotional consequences of withdrawal upon cessation. Tolerance without withdrawal. Is that addiction? The American Psychiatric Association, the Professional Society of Psychiatrists, are the gurus in this field. They are the publishers of the definitive Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or DSM, which defines and categorizes all psychiatric and behavioral disorders. Are addictive behaviors really addictive? The DSM has undergone various revisions in recent years to keep up with the field, particularly around the concept of addiction, the criteria for its diagnosis, and what it takes to be addicted. There have been two main obstacles in advancing the field of addiction, and both of them have to do with definition and criteria. The first is, can you be addicted to something that isn't a substance? The second is, if you demonstrate tolerance but not the physiological symptoms of withdrawal, can you still call it addiction? Answering these two questions has taken almost two decades of research and debate. The time between the publication of the DSM-4 in 1994 and the DSM-5 in 2013. And I promise you, by the time the DSM-6 rolls around, there will be further modifications. This field is in constant flux. For decades, The American Psychiatric Association said, no, behaviors like gambling weren't manifestations of addiction because the definition was tolerance plus withdrawal. Lack of withdrawal meant they didn't meet the criteria. But after decades of discussion, policymaking, and politicking, the DSM-5 has removed the requirement for withdrawal as an absolute diagnostic criterion. In so doing, the American Psychiatric Association has now changed the definition of substance-related and addictive disorders and allowed for the inclusion of addictive behaviors as well. Here's the current mix-and-match list of the 11 items of addiction. 1. Tolerance. 2. Withdrawal. 3. Craving or a strong desire to use. 4. Recurrent use resulting in a failure to fulfill major role obligations, such as work, school, or home. 5. Recurrent use in physically hazardous situations, for example, driving. 6. Use despite social or interpersonal problems caused or exacerbated by use. 7. Taking the substance or engaging in the behavior in larger amounts or over a longer period than intended. 8. Attempts to quit or cut down. 9. Time spent seeking or recovering from use. 10. Interference with life activities. 11. Use despite negative consequences. Instead of hard and fast criteria, the DSM-5 paradigm allows for scaling of severity. 2 or 3 of the above symptoms indicate a mild disorder, 4 or 5 symptoms indicate a moderate disorder, and 6 or more symptoms indicate a severe disorder. One question that people always ask, is there an addictive personality? What they really want to know is if addiction is genetic. There are a lot of children of alcoholic parents who are worried they will suffer the same fate. Many people are exposed to alcohol, and they don't get addicted. Many people, like me, have received the narcotic meperidine or Demerol as a pre-op for surgery, and they don't turn into heroin addicts. They want to know, if I'm not addicted now, I'm out of the woods, right? Is addiction driven by genes or by the substances themselves? There's no doubt there are certain genes that predispose people to alcoholism or smoking, but they all impact dopamine in some fashion. If a genetic defect or alteration reduces the number of dopamine receptors, motivation for reward will be increased. But there's been no gene identified to date that is 100% predictive. If you harbor a genetic variation of your dopamine receptor, you do have an increased relative risk, but it's not a fait accompli. Another issue that has plagued research on addiction is the question of cause and effect. Clearly, dopamine neurotransmission is associated with tolerance and withdrawal, but which comes first? Is it that dopamine drives the addictive behavior, or is it the addictive behavior that results in the changes in dopamine? A recent study looked at patients with Parkinson's disease, which occurs due to the degeneration of dopamine neurons in another brain area, the substantia nigra, which controls movement. Parkinson's disease patients experience severe rigidity and tremor, interfering with every aspect of their lives. The neurons in the substantia nigra that produce dopamine are not just dysfunctional, they're dying. Parkinson's patients are given drugs such as L-dopa carbidopa or Sinemet, and bromocriptine, or Parlidel, that increase or mimic natural dopamine signaling to restore movement. Many people have heard of L-DOPA before because of the movie Awakenings in 1990, based on the work of the late neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks. These are not drugs that are abused for their pleasurable properties. But these drugs are not specific for the areas that affect movement. They also interact with the dopamine receptors in regions that affect reward-related signaling. It turns out that these drugs drive a panoply of behaviors as unwanted side effects, including aggression, paranoia, and poor impulse control. Some patients have even become compulsive gamblers. Activation of the dopamine receptor means that the motivation for reward is enacted, with all of the positive and negative consequences that come with it. What these studies show is that the dopamine comes first. The drugs drive the dopamine signal, and the dopamine signal eventually drives these behaviors. Addiction transfer. What happens when, for one reason or another, you can't access your favorite fix? Once your dopamine pump is primed, it's just waiting to be fired for something, anything. People abstaining from one substance will frequently find themselves embroiled with another drug or activity, sex or gambling, that can generate the same effect. No Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is complete without coffee or rock stars or cookies or smoking out back. Because once you're addicted to one substance and your dopamine receptors are downregulated, you can easily become addicted to other substances as well. This is known as addiction transfer. Addiction transfer is a standard alternative. When the addiction you have becomes unacceptable to yourself, your spouse, or society, you move on to the next. A rational person would opt to switch from more addictive, dangerous, and societally eschewed substances to socially acceptable alternatives. It's common for those quitting smoking to start overeating, and most will inevitably gain weight. Many people have experienced the phenomenon of addiction transfer, for instance, when people switch from cigarettes to food. I have an oral fixation, they will say. William F. B. O'Reilly, a Republican advisor on Long Island, no, not that Bill O'Reilly, experienced addiction transfer firsthand and wrote about his experience in Newsday, Off Sugar and Wanting to Tear My Eyes Out. O'Reilly first started out hooked on cigarettes, then he switched to alcohol, and then he switched to sugar. But then his waistline grew, and finally there wasn't anything left to switch to. In fact, one of the early treatments for obesity was to take up smoking. When you're addicted to one substance and you find yourself abstaining, your dopamine's modus operandi is to find a substitute trigger. Bariatric surgery, including lap band surgery, reduces the amount of food one's able to consume at one time. You simply don't have the space in your stomach. You can't eat like you used to. But many of those undergoing the procedure had unhealthy addictions to food in the first place. Sacks of peanut butter cups generated the same type of fix for them as heroin might for someone else. Their dopamine pumps were primed and ready. So what do they switch to? Alcohol, the liquid drug. Carney Wilson, a self-described food addict and former singer in the band Wilson Phillips, underwent gastric bypass surgery in 2000, losing 150 pounds and landing a gig as a pinup model for Playboy. She's become somewhat of a poster child for the concept of addiction transfer, as she then found refuge in alcohol as opposed to food. The real thing. A perfect example of addiction transfer with long-lasting effects for the entire world was John Pemberton. He was an Atlanta pharmacist, and in 1886 he invented the formula for a very special and quite unique carbonated beverage. On May 29th, just 3 weeks later, Pemberton placed the first advertisement in the Atlanta Journal for his soft drink, which wasn't so soft in those days, which from that day forward would be known as Coca-Cola. The story of Pemberton and Coca-Cola is widely known, the stuff of urban legend. Back then, carbonation was a big deal, requiring special high-pressure jets to force enough carbon dioxide into solution. There was no method for reinforcing standard glass bottles, so carbonation had to be done in pharmacies with special equipment and drunk on site. This became known as the soda fountain. Thus, Coca-Cola was originally sold only in pharmacies. But there was another reason as well. What is not widely known is that Pemberton was a morphine addict after being wounded in the Civil War. The reason he developed his sacred formula was a long-standing attempt to wean himself off his addiction. But his addiction was ruining his profits, his business, and his life. He spent the next 21 years trying to come up with an opium-free painkiller. He went through several iterations without success. Ultimately, he developed a concoction that included cocaine, alcohol, caffeine, and sugar. Four separate hedonic substances, four somewhat weaker dopamine reward drugs to take the place of one very strong one. Pemberton mixed the four with carbonated water, thought to have its own hedonic properties. However, due to the temperance movement that overtook the South in the late 1800s, and due to many Civil War veterans developing alcoholism, he removed the alcohol and voila. However, in 1888, Pemberton sold the formula and the rights to Atlanta businessman Asa Candler for a mere $2,500, and Candler proceeded to turn Coca-Cola into the most famous brand in the world. Why so cheap, you ask? Because Pemberton needed the money. Bad. And you can guess why. He was sick, addicted, and penniless. He never did beat his morphine addiction, and he died the same year at age 57 in severe pain. Not surprisingly, if you go to the Coca-Cola Museum in Atlanta, this sordid story is nowhere to be found. In 1903, the federal government required the removal of cocaine for public sale, leaving only caffeine and sugar. Were these two substances alone enough to maintain the hook? Of course. Why do you think Starbucks sells Frappuccinos? Candler saw his Coca-Cola placed into pharmacy soda fountains all over the country. It is now available in 208 out of the 209 countries in the world. Only North Korea is Coke-less. Myanmar capitulated in 2012 and Cuba in 2015. And is by far the world's most recognized brand. And for good reason. It's a delivery vehicle that mainlines two addictive compounds straight to your nucleus accumbens. Sugar just happens to be the cheapest of our many substances of abuse. But all these substances do essentially the same thing. By driving dopamine release, they all acutely drive reward, and in the process, they also drive consumption. Yet, when taken to extreme, every stimulator of reward can instead result in addiction. For heroin or cocaine, you need a dealer and a wad of cash. For alcohol or nicotine, you'd need an ID. But for sugar, all you need is a quarter or a grandma. Sugar is the cheap thrill, the reward everyone on the planet is exposed to, the reward everyone can afford. Everyone's an addict, and all of your relatives are pushers. And it's only one of two addictive substances that are legal and generally available, the other one being caffeine. That's why soda's such a big seller. It's two addictive substances rolled into one. Everyone has become a willing consumer of the two lowest common denominators. Sugar and caffeine are diet staples for much of the world today. Coffee is the second most important commodity behind petroleum, and sugar is fourth. Sugar being a primary example, substances have been purified and mainlined straight to your dopamine receptors. If you don't exercise caution, you'll blow your neurons out.